All right, as I said, we're going to come on in this hour to Platonism and Neoplatonism and attempt to give you a crash course in Greek philosophy. And I apologize if you crash while I'm doing the crash course, okay? Platonism, here our outline will be progressive development, practical results, critical estimate. Progressive development, as I said, there are three stages associated with Plato, circa 350 BC, Philo, AD 50, Plotinus, circa AD 200, corresponding to Platonism, Middle Platonism, and Neoplatonism. Hey, Platonism. Now, Plato and Aristotle, who was not a Platonist in the true sense, were concerned with the problem of epistemology, i.e. the problem of knowing, or the question of how do we know. Plato was convinced that mere sensory observation of the world could not impart true knowledge. This led him to postulate an ideal world composed of forms, also called ideas, also called universals, because he was convinced that true knowledge was attainable, but not just by looking at the material world. An illustration of this is that Plato would say that when we know an apple, we don't really know an apple, but rather we know the ideas of redness, roundness, sweetness, tartness, and crunchiness in that peculiar combination we call an apple. So what we know is not the apple in itself, but these ideas in the peculiar relationship, what we call apples. But this theory raises several questions. How come the material world reflects these ideas? Well, the answer is that the demiurge, who formed the material world, impressed these ideas on the matter out of which it was formed, striving to copy the ideal world in the material world. How come we recognize these ideals or forms in the world? Well, there is the rest of the story. The soul is preexistent and essentially part of this ideal world. Souls don't come into existence either by the Christian theories of creationism, that they're created with whenever a new person is formed in the womb, nor do they come into existence by traducianism, the idea that they are somehow traduced from the souls of their parents. No, souls are preexistent. They're actually preexistent to the world. They lived in a previous existence. So the soul recognizes the ideals impressed on the material world by the demiurge because it recollects them from a previous existence. So learning is recollectio, recollection. Learning for Plato, then, is recollection. Our forgetfulness of the ideal world is due to the shock of being placed in a corporal body. I mean, that's no small thing, you know. You fall in this pre-existent world, God or the demiurge or somebody or other slaps you into a material body, and, I mean, that's a shock to the system, and you forget everything. You're kind of in a kind of amnesia until gradually, as you look at the world, you remember things, you recollect things. Now, the demiurge forms the world, but matter itself is eternal. And really, Plato has at least three co-ultimate and co-eternal principles. Neoplatonism is going to try to deal with that problem of having three co-eternal principles. But for Plato, the three co-eternal principles were matter, the demiurge, and the ideas culminating in the idea of the good. The idea of the good was the very best idea. So you have the world of ideas. The demiurge takes the world from the world of ideas and impresses those ideas on the material world. And we remember them from our previous pre-existent life. That brings us to Middle Platonism. Aristotle forms the connecting link between Platonism and Middle Platonism. Aristotle postulated a supreme mind as the unmoved mover or creator. In Middle Platonism, this mind is identified with Plato's form of the good. At the top of the hierarchy of the ideal world is the mind equal the good equal the unmoved mover. And this begins to approach a kind of theism. In fact, the most famous Middle Platonist was a Jew, Philo, who argued that ideas were simply part of the mind of God. And that brings us to Neoplatonism. Plotinus, now notice his date here, AD 205 to 70. So Neoplatonism is now the first form of Platonism that's been strategically and severely impacted by Christianity, okay? And to understand Neoplatonism, you have to understand that it kind of arose as a, and was created as a competitor religion philosophy to Christianity. The Neoplatonists were great opponents of Christianity, and yet also influenced Christianity and were influenced by it. So Plotinus, who lived from 205 to 70, he was a contemporary of Origen, the great early church father, and perhaps some back and forth between them. He was the great systematizer of Neoplatonism and, in a sense, of the whole development of pagan Greek philosophy. Though he was younger than Origen and Clement of Alexandria, he enunciated the form of Platonism, which deeply influenced them and Christian theology. Neoplatonism was a reaction against the materialism of the Stoics and Epicureans. It stressed the importance of the immaterial world as the necessary basis of philosophy. Though it was Platonic in its major inspiration, it combined Aristotelian, Stoic, and even Oriental elements. With Aristotle, it identified the idea of the one with God as the unmoved mover. With Oriental thought, like Gnosticism, it utilized an emanation theory to explain the existence of the universe. With Stoicism, it identified the demiurge with the world soul, the principle animating and organizing the material world. Now, the ideal world was identified with the mind. Out of the mind emanates the demiurge, or the soul. The higher soul transcends the world, the lower soul animates it. Two souls, then, or at least the higher and lower dimension of the soul. Matter out of which the world is formed really doesn't... Now, this will catch you. Matter really doesn't exist. Because matter is non-being. Matter is nothingness. So the material world is only a mirror reflecting being. It itself is non-being and evil. And of course, it's easy then to say that being is light, non-being is darkness. And so, you say, wow, that's interesting. The material world is non-being, and it's also evil. And so, conclusion, evil doesn't really exist. Evil is simply a deprivation of the good. It's nothing in itself. And in fact, one fairly famous theodicy is based upon the ideal that evil is nothing. I don't agree with that theodicy, but that's true. The mind, however, is not the highest reality or being. Mind itself emanates from the One, or God. Since the One is above the mind, now catch this, it's beyond reason, it is ineffable, incomprehensible, and above being. In contrast, the mind is the principle of rationality containing the ideas and is thus knowable. Thus, ultimate reality can only be attained by mystical experience, not by reason or the intellect. You have to go beyond reason to get to the One, which is ultimate reality. Okay? That idea has been very influential in the history of philosophy. I can show you that idea, in fact, in postmodernism. Anyhow. Reality in Neoplatonism, then, is conceived as a scale of being. Proceeding from being at the top, you have the One, equal God, principle of being. Then the mind equals the ideal world, principle of diversity and reason. Then you have the higher soul, what transcends the material world. The lower soul that animates the material world, and this is also the demiurge. And then you have the world, and the world itself is arranged in a hierarchy of being. According to Neoplatonists, A lot of Gnostics influenced by them. At the pinnacle of the material world is man. Under him is woman. Then you have the animals. Then you have, you know, rocks and stones. So, or the animals, the plant world, and then rocks and stones. By the way, it's really the Gnostics influenced by Neoplatonism and these Platonic ideas that taught that women were inferior to men on the scale of being. It wasn't Christians. Whatever Christianity taught, it wasn't the idea that women were inferior beings to men, taught by Neoplatonism and Gnosticism. Anyhow. Now you notice how Neoplatonism has reduced the plurality of ultimate principles to the one from which all emanates. You also notice how religious this system has become, and we'll come back to that. Practical results. Politically, when we speak of the political results of Neoplatonism, it is of Plato, to whom the Neoplatonists owe so much, that we must first speak. Plato was deeply interested in politics. This may even be the heart of a system. I had the privilege, I guess, one time to actually read The Republic and his view of what an ideal state was like, and the laws. I didn't read that. He founded his academy, it is said, in order to train the statesman who would found his ideal state. In The Republic, Plato defines justice in terms of order or harmony. Justice in the individual is the ordering of the will and the appetites by the supreme reason. There's another idea deeply influential on Christian theology. Justice in the state will be the ordering of the different elements of society in terms of reason or philosophy by a ruling elite, or even one philosopher king. In case you missed it, that just expressed totalitarianism. Don't miss that, because that's what that is. It's totalitarian. The philosopher king. And his ordering of society is ultimate justice. So, by definition, whatever he does is justice. The guardians, who are at once the military, police force, and rulers of Plato's state, must live in a material and sexual communism. Oh, that'll work all right. Any physically unfit or unlicensed children must be disposed of, because they tend to the disorder of society. Via abortion or infanticide. Yes, they had abortion back then as well. There is no rule of law since the philosopher kings are the walking embodiment of law. There's no rule of law since the philosopher kings are the walking embodiment of law. These rulers are the supreme law, competent to use even falsehood to achieve their will. If it takes a lie to get order in society, so be it. So there's no conception of personal freedom here at all. The interest of the many, to echo Star Trek, are completely subordinate to the one, to the order, to the one, to the philosopher king, pardon me. This is what Plato means by justice. This emphasis on the one at the expense of the many only grows and does not wane in Middle and Neoplatonism. At the same time, there's a growing religious and otherworldly orientation which actually tended to undermine and make secondary political interest. Nonetheless, pagan Neoplatonism was closely associated with patriotism, although it arose after the conclusion of the Pax Romana in a age that was not so enamored with the Roman Empire and the promise it held of world peace and world order. Because now, in the 3rd century, the barbarians began to knock at the door. At any rate, we come B, then, to its religious interest. First of all, the religious character of Neoplatonism. Seneca and Boke remarked, Neoplatonism was more than a philosophical system. It was then a religion, and like Oriental cults, preached salvation. Now, the character of religious Neoplatonism is not difficult to see. The great goal is to scale the ladder of being, attain to the ecstatic experience of becoming one with the one, i.e., the beatific vision. Now, its different characteristics may be correlated with this task. So your idea, the idea for any human being with his immortal soul, is to rise to the scale of being. Of course, that involves, first of all, philosophical contemplation to rise to the level of the mind and the great ideas of the mind. Okay? And then it involves rising even higher than that and leaving behind reason to attain the irrational, ecstatic vision of the One, which, since it is by definition not rational, has to be attained in some other way. Now, in its religious character, it manifested optimism. The Neoplatonists thought that this could be done, that people could rise in the scale of being. All reality was thought of as fired by an ardent longing to return to the One. And spurred on by this knowledge, the Neoplatonist is optimistic of success. And then there is asceticism. This confidence is necessary because the first task of the philosopher who wants to ascend the scale of being is to set oneself free of the material order. Because what's at the bottom of the scale of being? The world of matter. To achieve, therefore, an ascent on the scale of being, you have to leave behind matter, and you therefore have to crucify all physical desires. Part and parcel of such asceticism was the desire to flee from worldly affairs, which entangled one in fleshly concerns. And this is, of course, a kind of incipient monasticism, which, in fact, was not unimportant in the development of later Christian monasticism. A third characteristic of Neoplatonism as a religion is speculation. Since mind is the first emanation, it must be passed through to attain the One. Metaphysical speculations, rational contemplations of the universe, and a philosophy must absorb one's attention. And then the last thing that had to characterize this was mysticism. The One is beyond mind and reason. It is, do you like that old candy bar? Indescribably delicious. And therefore, you have to achieve the beatific vision, you have to use mysticism. The ultimate step in this journey, then, is up the scale of being as a mystic, non-rational trance, which gives the beatific vision. Now, what was the effect of all this on Christianity? Well, Neoplatonism profoundly influenced early Christian thought, if you haven't already recognized that from some of the similarities. Christian asceticism and monasticism, subordinationism and semi-Pelagianism all owed a great deal to Neoplatonic influence. And this influence is epitomized in Origen of Alexandria. In a number of ways. A, Origen's asceticism was exhibited in his whole way of life. Specifically, it's generally believed that when he was a young man, he castrated himself in order to free himself from fleshly desires. Now, I've heard different historians argue a little bit about that, but on the whole, I think it's the opinion that he actually did this as a young man. Later, as a Christian bishop and teacher, he told people they shouldn't do it. But I think the consensus, at least not maybe not consensus, but the majority actually think he did when he was a young man. Origen's subordinationism has to do with the way he used Neoplatonism's emanation theory to explain the Trinity. He equated God the Father with the One, God the Son with the mind, and God the Spirit with the world soul. Human souls came next in this hierarchy. This system of thought was at the root of the Arianism that later developed. The line between creator and creature was drawn, but drawn rather arbitrarily between the spirit and human souls. And there is no inherent reason, in fact, in Origen's system, why the line between God and not God shouldn't be drawn between the Father and the Son. And so Neoplatonism carried within it the seeds of the idea that the Son was akin to the mind, the world soul, that the demiurge, the creator of the world, and as such, he was an attenuated, diluted, less toxic form of God, made so in order to come in contact with a world that the One was forever remote from, forever utterly transcendent over. See, Oregon's optimism with reference to man's soul was at the root of the positive reception given to semi-Pelagianism at the time of Augustine in the Eastern Church. You may know, or maybe you don't, that after they chased Pelagius out of North Africa, he and actually condemned him in certain synods of the church, that he went elsewhere, and he went to the Eastern Church and was well accepted. The reason is because of the influence of, among other people, Oregon, and the strong idea of human free will that emanated from Neoplatonism through Oregon and other Christian teachers. For Oregon, free will was absolute. In fact, Oregon's system of theology is built around free will. And so because free will is ultimate, Satan might repent and be saved. He has free will. Heavenly saints might fall from bliss because they might live in heaven a million years and then decide that they're tired of being good and change their mind and sin. And they could do that because they have free will. Souls are born depraved. Well, how do you explain that, Oregon? Oh, easily. Because they sinned in a pre-existent state. And so people are born into the condition they deserve because of the degree of sin that they committed in a pre-existent state. So all sorts of reconstructions of Christian theology emerged out of Oregon's systemic emphasis on free will. Now, therefore, the Eastern Church held, at the very best, a lot of them, a semi-Pelagian view of conversion, because they had to hold that man takes the first step by his free will, and only then and after that, God will give us grace. So free will brings you faith, and faith brings you grace. And you notice, of course, that this viewpoint has profoundly affected modern Christianity as well. Critical estimate of Neoplatonism. A, a Christian must reject Neoplatonism's monistic view of reality. The major difference between Platonism and Christianity, and especially Neoplatonism and Christianity, is that Greek philosophy in the form of Neoplatonism had no conception of creation. A creator-creature distinction is utterly absent. What you have in Platonic thought is either being, and insofar as we have being, we share it with the Supreme Being. We are only a diluted form of his being. Or we are non-being, that is to say, matter. So in the Neoplatonic thought, there is being and non-being, equivalent to soul and body, but there is only one kind of being. And in the greatest and most important contrast to that, in Christianity, you have two kinds of being, the creator and the created. That is enormous philosophical, Christian philosophical implications, by the way. Well, look at that. I have a C and then a B. That's an interesting way to outline, isn't it? C before B, the Neoplatonic view involves a too pessimistic view of the body and a too optimistic view of the soul. The soul is viewed as almost a spark of divine fire, and the body is viewed as inherently sinful, even devilish, and certainly opposed to the soul, and certainly not ever intended as the permanent dwelling place of the soul. And both have profoundly influenced Christian thought. And then B, a Christian must reject Neoplatonism's view of the one and the many. Now, this is interesting, and maybe you have to have had a little college philosophy to appreciate this or thought about things. But what is the Christian view of the one and the many? For a Christian, which is ultimate, the one or the many? Well, you say, it's obviously the one, God. Really? What about the Trinity? Is God more ultimately one than he is three? See, the point is that in Christianity, the one and the many are actually co-ultimate. The one and three, the oneness and threeness of God are co-ultimate. And philosophically, this means that for Christians, there is no ultimacy of the one over the many or the many over the one. the needs of the many do not outweigh the needs of the one, Captain Kirk. Or Spock actually said that, right? So what's the Christian view of the one and the many? Which is ultimate? Well, Neoplatonism dissolves the many into the one. Because so absolute oneness, mystical oneness is absolute, and it unfolds itself at a lower level into the many ideas of the mind. You see that? So oneness is ultimate. Manyness is less ultimate. Whereas in Christianity, you see, because we have one kind of being, and my diagram is wrong there, because, you see, Platonism has a dotted line between the one and the many. Christianity has a big black line that's not dotted, and I've got to change that in my notes. But at any rate, above the line that distinguishes God from not God, even above that line, there is a one and a many. God is one, and God is three, and this eternally and ultimately. So at the divine level, the one and the many are co-ultimate. And at the level of creation then, in creation, we see universals, onenesses, and particulars, manynesses. That's hard to say, manynesses. On the created level, okay? Let me give you an illustration of this. In the world, ethically, you have both the one and the many. In the Bible, all the Old Testament law consists in this: love God and love your neighbor as yourself, right? Which actually boils down to love God and love his images. And so that boils down to love God, right? So there's an ultimate oneness. And yet this ultimate oneness of love God is unfolded in the two laws of love God and love your neighbor as yourself, as unfolded in Ten Commandments. And these Ten Commandments are not less ultimate than loving God. Those Ten Commandments are the commanded ways of loving God. You see? So ethically you have the equal ultimacy of one and the many. Situation ethics dissolves all the laws into love. That's what situation ethics is. You dissolve all the laws into love. Love is ultimate. All the laws are less ultimate. It's all right to murder somebody if you do it out of love. It's all right to commit adultery if you do it out of love. It's all right to steal if you do it out of love. This is Fletcher's situation ethics. But see, Christianity teaches that dissolving of the many into the one can never happen. The many are as ultimate as the one, because the many simply tell us God's perspective on what it means to love him. So we can never say that loving God means, therefore, that we can commit adultery. Loving God always means not committing adultery. Well, so there are ethical, and then you see this in all the sciences are constantly trying to find universal laws and fit all the particulars into them. And so there are these universals and particulars. This is the way of human knowledge. And the point is, Christianity postulates that the world is composed of universals and particulars and equal ultimacy, because in fact, God is a universal and three particulars in equal ultimacy. Think about that for the next 5 years, okay? Okay, Stoicism. Stoicism, the last of the three great philosophies at the time of the birth of Christianity. Some things by way of introduction. First of all, the importance of Stoicism. The importance of Stoicism can be underscored in a couple of different ways. Its importance for Roman history is epitomized in the statement that it counted among its adherents. Seneca was a very influential advisor of Nero in Nero's early years. Epictetus, a famous freedman and philosopher of Rome. And Marcus Aurelius, the emperor, as well as countless others, many of them also influential. Cicero, you've heard that name, even if you're not a historian. Cicero, the Latin translator of Greek philosophy and famous senator of the Republic, was also strongly influenced by Stoicism. Its importance for Christianity is symbolized by the fact that Paul cites a Stoic, Acts 17:28a, Aretas, which when he says, "For we also are his offspring." By the way, the phrase, "In him we live and move and have our being," is also a quotation from a Greek poet. Tarsus, the hometown of the apostle, had strong historical associations with Stoicism. So what was the origin of Stoicism? Stoicism was founded by Zeno, but it was not called Zenoism. Aren't we all thankful for that? Zeno of Cyprus, who lived something like 335 to 263, or maybe 342 to 270. The name derives from the Stoa Poikile, or Poikile, where Zeno taught in Athens. This phrase means the painted or multicolored porticoist. So a Stoicist is a multicolored porticoist, but it's easier to call them Stoics. Okay? Besides Zeno, its most famous advocates were Cleanthes and Chrysippus, who succeeded him as the leaders of his schools. Stoicism, as well as other Greek philosophies, were planted at Rome by a famous Greek embassy in 155 BC, which included actually three representatives of the three famous Greek philosophies, Epicureanism, Platonism, and Stoicism. Character. In contrast to Epicureanism, the Stoic philosophers exhibit a great deal of independence, originality, tendency to mix their beliefs with those of other schools. Kelly remarks, both the Stoicism and to an even greater extent the Platonism, which flourished in the first two Christian centuries, show important deviations from their classical prototypes. Each had borrowed from the other, and indeed the intellectual attitude of great numbers of educated people might be described as either a Platonizing Stoicism or a Stoicizing Platonism. Well, that's all by way of introduction. What is their cosmology? That's a big word that means their understanding of the world, the universe. Well, it's first of all, can be described as pantheistic materialism. The doctrine of the universe. The Stoics were materialists. Reality was something you could knock your knuckles against. Well, except that their ultimate idea of what material was like, a force field, fluid, or gas. In the present universe, formed out of this original living fire, the Stoics distinguished two principles, an active and a passive principle. The active principle is a fiery vapor akin to the original fire in its purest state. This is the logos, or the world soul. The passive principle also emerges out of the original fire and is motionless and inert, like the ashes of a fire. It is enlivened by the logos, the active principle, and at long intervals the universe returns to its original condition in a universal conflagration. That is to say, universal fire, or ekpyrosis. So, actually, the Stoics believed that the world was going to end, insofar as the world ever ended, in a great universal fire. Interesting. Alexander Pope, though he was not himself a Stoic in any formal sense, it epitomizes the Stoic view of the universe in his famous lines, "All are but parts of one stupendous whole, whose body nature is, and God the soul." Which summarizes Stoicism pretty well. But we can say something about the doctrine of man. Man is just a microcosm of this universe. Just as in the universe, you have passive matter enlivened, formed, and guided by the universal logos. So in man, there is a spark of this universal logos, which enlivens, forms, and guides this material body. These sparks are called the seminal logoi, or, to quote the Greek, the spermatikoi logoi, the seed words. And so if you take your pen and you have written notes in front of you, and you draw a big circle around matter and logos, and then a smaller concentric circle around logos, and do the same thing around body and logos spermatikoi, then that illustration, which is only partially done on the page, will be complete. Okay? Now, Stoicism is also characterized by determinism, but not blind determinism, teleological determinism. The great world soul determines all that happens and does it for a purpose. So determinism is the teaching that all things are determined in advance of their occurrence. There are two kinds. As I just said, blind determinism that says that the determining agent is impersonal, without foresight or providence. Modern behavioralists, for instance, illustrate this sort of determinism with their chemical determinism. You're just all Pavlov's dogs, conditioned to respond the way you're going to respond by your past history. It's all determined, but nobody's determining anything. It's just happening by necessity. Teleological determinism implies a purpose behind the determinate events. It implies a personal intelligence, foreknowing, guiding, and determining the events of history to a foreknown and determined end. The Stoics held as central to their philosophy the doctrine of providence, and so were teleological determinists. The poetry of Cleanthes enunciates it. Lead me, O Zeus, and thou my destiny. Whate'er the path that ye ordain for me, fearless I'll follow. But if I refuse, still I must follow, howsoe'er I choose. Now, this poem might seem to suggest that human choices are meaningless. In fact, many charge all determinism with making human choices meaningless, ethics meaningless, and with the implication of godlessness. But several replies can actually be made by the Stoic. First, God ordains the means as well as the ends, and thus our choices as means do make a difference. Second, each man contains a seminal logos. Thus, his choices are meaningful, proceeding as they do from the seminal logos. Third, history and experience teach that determinists appear to take ethics far more seriously than those who emphasize free will. Contrast the Stoics, who are determinists, with the laid-back, you know, state lifestyle of the Epicureans, who emphasized free will. Gordon H. Clark asserts, it is also a curious and to the free will Epicurean an inexplicable fact of history that determinism, at least teleological determinism, is regularly associated with a strict and vigorous morality, while the exponents of freedom have tended to a free and easy mode of life. Certain it is that this is the contrast in antiquity. And Clark, by the way, in that same section, look at the footnote there, also contrasts the strict morals of the Pharisee and Essene sects, who in fact were predestinarians, with the looseness of the Sadducees, who believed in free will. Interesting. What was the epistemology of Stoicism? The Stoic view of knowledge and how we know is strikingly opposed to that of Platonism. Platonism divorced knowledge from the material world. For it, all knowledge was rooted in the world of ideas. Stoicism taught that all knowledge was derived via sensory impressions. While the mind might perform certain operations with this data, it was basically a tabula rasa, a blank tablet. Probably we get the word erased from rasa, I suppose. Anyway, I'm guessing. Without these sensory impressions, there is no knowledge. Ideas are only mental conceptions that have no real existence outside the individual. Whereas for Platonists, the ideas were the real things, and the sensory impressions were simply the secondary to them. Because of his materialism, the Stoic also had no trouble explaining how the material world could convey knowledge to an immaterial soul about the ideal world, since both body and soul are basically one substance, both material. There's no difficult dichotomy to deal with. The criterion of knowledge is the irresistible conviction which sensory impressions create in the mind, not abstract reason. The material world is thus far more positive, important, and significant for the Stoic than for the Platonist. And so Stoics had something far more to do with Aristotle than with Plato. I think I've shown some of you the famous picture. You know the famous picture that has all the great philosophers in the history of Greece. And foremost in the picture are Plato and Aristotle, right? Plato with his finger lifted to heaven, because this is where knowledge comes from. Aristotle with his hand pointed to the earth, because this is where knowledge comes from. Well, it's clear that the Stoics agreed more with Aristotle than with Plato. If you've never seen the picture, look it up online. It's right there. Ethics. The nature of their ethics. Ethics was the heart and center of Stoic thought, and it was grounded in really two ideas. The universe is governed by law, and the essential nature of man is reason. So the, quote, Stoic way of life could be summed up in the phrase, to live in harmony with nature. Living in harmony with nature meant two things. It meant first to act according to one's deepest nature, the seminal logos, one's reason. So it meant to act rationally. It also meant, second, to fall in line with the plans of the universal logos. This may be called submission to fate or cooperation with destiny, depending on one's perspective. Such a perspective could well promote moral strength. Bruce comments, a man's fate cannot be avoided, but it will be easier for himself if he cooperates with it and accepts it gladly instead of struggling vainly against it. At least this fate was not capricious. It was part of the universal logos or design. When men were convinced that they were caught up into this grand design, the conviction gave rise to great moral strength and purpose of mind, stimulating them to noble endurance and action. Living in harmony with nature demanded, therefore, strength of will, total self-mastery. It meant being stoic. It meant bringing one's body into line with the plans and aims of the logos. Intrinsic value for this approach to ethics lies in the will. Virtue is not the enjoyment of pleasure, as it is for the Epicurean. Virtue is not contemplation of the mind, as it is in very much measure it was for the Platonists. Virtue is strength of will. Self-mastery. Even if you can't achieve your purposes, you can be the master of yourself and your own desires. Logically, the details of Stoic ethics differed markedly from those of Epicureanism, but at one point there was agreement. Suicide was a legitimate option for both Epicurus and Stoic. In fact, its founder died by his own hand. I think the reference there is to Zeno. The ethics of Stoicism were popular with the conservative Roman society. It meshed well with the Roman stress on gravitas, which meant moral seriousness. Its idea also of the world state and advocacy of involvement in the social context were congenial to Roman imperialism. Clark remarks, the ideal of virtue differs in many particulars from the Epicureans' ideal of ease. Whereas the school of pleasure found family life too much of a nuisance, the Stoics defended monogamy and the family with its reciprocal duties. They advocated education for women, even courses in philosophy. Whereas the Epicureans withdrew from politics, the Stoics stressed patriotism and civic responsibilities. But we must also think of the incompatibility of their ethics with Christianity. Stoic ethics appealed in many ways to Christians and, in fact, would profoundly influence later Christian thought. Stoics emphasized family and social responsibilities. They spoke in terms of the fitting and the proper, in terms akin to those words used in the New Testament. Marcus Aurelius' Meditations, even though he was a persecutor of Christians, would later become a religious classic in the medieval church. Think of that. One wonders what Marcus Aurelius would have thought of that. Anyway, Bruce remarks, it's interesting to speculate what further meditation Marcus would have bequeathed to posterity could he have foreseen this development. But at least two pivotal points, Stoicism's ethics were clearly incompatible with Christianity. There was, first of all, no hope of personal immortality at the basis of its ethics. I mean, everything is going to merge again with the world soul, so no personal immortality. Secondly, the Stoic ideal of self-sufficiency, autarkia, was diametrically opposed to a Christian perspective. It was, of course, rooted in the pagan view of the soul as a divine spark. Bruce comments, the Stoics were at heart sturdy individualists. They tended to put up with their brother. They tended to put up with their brother men rather than to love them. But when conditions of life became too intolerable for a self-respecting Stoic to endure with human dignity, suicide was regarded as a proper way of release. Politics. The most original contribution of Stoicism was its advocacy of the world state, the cosmopolis, the world city. And they deduced the idea of a world state from their pantheism. Marcus Aurelius epitomized this viewpoint when he said, "My city and country, so far as I am Antoninus, is Rome. But so far as I am a man, it is the world." Though certain Stoic ideas are admirable, for instance, this ideal of human brotherhood, Stoicism's world state would have been inevitably totalitarian. The Stoic, like the Platonist, must inevitably dissolve the many into the one. Because of its pantheism, Stoicism viewed all men as ultimately one, differing only in secondary incidentals. There could be no ultimate balance between the one Rome and the many its citizens. The choice was really anarchy or totalitarianism, and the Stoics would have chosen totalitarianism. Rush Dooney cites Marcus Aurelius in this regard. The social goal, the one, Rome, was as paramount for Marcus Aurelius as for his early forebears. The alternative, as he saw it, was either oneness or anarchy. Quote, "But art thou discontented with thy share in the whole? Recall the alternative, either providence or atoms." And the abundant proofs there are that the universe is, as it were, a state. The alternative was either a universal state, a whole which absorbed all and moved through a repetitious cycle of growth or decay, or universal anarchy and particularity. It was for him a choice between law or no law. In this picture, the individual is nothing in the whole. Perhaps Platonism tended more sternly to totalitarianism, but it is still very apparent in Stoicism. And lastly, and pretty briefly, the moral climate. Having examined the religious trends and philosophical movements of the early empire, we must examine by way of conclusion its moral climate. And as we turn from philosophy to morality, we are like the small boy that fell off the roof of the barn into the manure pile. Because the great old Roman world was a moral dung heap. Many illustrations of the grossly immoral climate of society might be given. Homosexuality, for instance, was widespread and accepted in upper-class Greek society. Socrates and Plato both practiced homosexuality. Not only philosophy, but also religion contributed to the general putrefaction. Many of the cults included ritual prostitution, both of the male and female varieties. Abortion's first century equivalent was commonly practiced. Bruce remarks how little conscience was made of this by decent-minded people is illustrated by a letter written in 1 BC by an Egyptian laborer at Alexandria to his wife in Axarhynchus in terms of real affection, instructing her with regard to the baby that she is expecting, quote, "If it is a boy, keep it. If a girl, expose it." The writer of the epistle to Diognetus mentions as something noteworthy about Christians the fact that they do not expose their children. Now, two factors beyond humanity's native depravity were active in contributing to the general moral breakdown. First, political upheaval had uprooted many from their ancestral homes. This removed them from the influences of common grace resident in their family and cultural ties and placed them in cities filled with such uprooted masses. Secondly, unparalleled prosperity provided increased opportunities and therefore more extensive abilities for debauchery, the great cycle of Sodom and Gomorrah. Much more about, be said about that, but better perhaps left unsaid, except that you know that if you think American society is corrupt, and it is, you ain't seen nothing yet compared to the Roman Empire in its early days. Okay, we'll stop right there and come in the third lecture to talk about some other aspects of the expansion of the church. Do you have any questions? Questions? How'd you do with that brief history of Greek philosophy? all too brief or all too philosophical, probably. It is. I find it interesting, but then I'm weird, so. John Ferguson says, I think it's fascinating how much of today's beliefs can be traced back to the era we're studying. Well, it is fascinating, and the fact is, what did somebody say? That the history of philosophy is a vast number of footnotes to Plato. I think that's true. Okay. Thanks a lot. We'll come back at 10 minutes, about 8.